This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Many LGBT Australians will know Rodney Croom as the spokesperson for the Tasmanian Gay and Lesbian Rights Group. In that capacity, he fronted the long and bitter and ultimately successful campaign to decriminalise homosexuality in Tasmania. In 1993, as the co-convener of the Australian Council for Lesbian and Gay Rights, Rodney became the first gay advocate to speak at a United Nations forum. And he joins us now to look back at the role Australia can and should be playing in the decriminalisation of homosexuality internationally. Rodney, good morning to you.
Hi, Jeff. Hi, Marg.
How are you?
Oh, great, thanks. Yep, pretty good.
So what's the current situation around the world? Just briefly, I know that, you know, if you go into every country, we'll be here for 3 hours, but just broadly, what's the situation regarding decriminalisation or legality of homosexuality and homosexual activity?
Well, of course, this is timely because there is currently a resolution from France before the UN General Assembly, which deals specifically with this issue of those countries around the world that continue to criminalise homosexuality. Most of those countries are located in Africa, the Middle East, and some in Eastern Asia. Most of them either have those criminal sanctions because they reflect Islamic law, or they are an inheritance from a time when these particular countries were British colonies in the 19th century, and Britain, as we know, had those laws. And so those laws in former British colonies, like, for instance, Zambia or Zimbabwe or Papua New Guinea in our region, or Malaysia, closely reflect the criminal laws that we used to have in Australia, Tasmania being the last state, as you mentioned before, to remove them. So it's generally in the developing world and generally either Muslim countries or former British colonies.
But there are quite a few close to home still, aren't there? You mentioned Papua New Guinea, Fiji, Tonga, Solomon Islands.
Yes, it's almost like an arc.
Yep.
that runs across our north, beginning in Papua New Guinea, the Solomons, Vanuatu, Fiji, Tonga. In that case, it's all inheritance from former colonial times.
And places that our homosexuals go for holidays.
Well, indeed.
So, and I guess, does that put us at risk?
There have been cases in Fiji in the last few years where Australian citizens having relationships with same-sex relationships with Fijian men have been subject to criminal sanctions or police intimidation because of the laws in Fiji.
So what can and should the Australian government be doing? What is it doing, if anything, about these countries?
The Australian government will be a supporter of the resolution I mentioned before that the French have put up, along with quite a few countries. That's received a bit of controversy because it's been condemned by the Vatican, not surprisingly.
Not surprisingly. However, in the first hour, we had someone from a very successful Italian drag group who was, you know, feted in Italy for many, many years, the Flag Sisters. And the Italian people, even though the Vatican has a problem with it, the Italian people don't seem to.
No. There's two very different things there.
What
Italians think about sexual diversity and what the Vatican thinks. I really think when it comes to the Vatican's line on these things, it's not appealing to European or North American or Australian opinion anymore at all. Mm. It's really trying to win over converts in places that it thinks, where it thinks homophobia has some credibility still.
Yes.
And chiefly, again, in its proselytising war against, particularly against Islam in Africa.
Yes.
So that's really where its comments are aimed. But there was also some concern about whether the United States might sign this particular resolution, and not surprisingly, with the election of Barack Obama, it will.
Mm.
So Australia's pretty much within the mainstream of Western opinion, at least, on these issues. The key issue, I think, for Australia is whether it becomes a more proactive advocate against persecution and criminalisation in other countries. It was in the particularly in the early 1990s, at the conference that you mentioned earlier that I spoke at in Vienna, the UN Human Rights Conference, Australia actually took the lead of all the countries in the world and made the first ever statement by a nation on sexual orientation, what was called sexual orientation discrimination.
Yeah.
I was there. I remember very clearly that as soon as the Australian delegate said the words sexual orientation discrimination, heads popped up from all over the place. This was a big thing.
They started listening.
And all of a sudden, other countries that have since gone on to advocate quite strongly, like Canada, the Netherlands, Sweden, they were empowered to do the same thing. Unfortunately, in the mid to late 1990s, Australia stepped back from that under the Howard government. To his credit, Alexander Downer, as Foreign Minister, continued to push this a bit, but really the momentum and the energy went out of it. And I've yet to see the Rudd government take up the kind of... take up the Keating government's baton. I'd really like to see Australia become more proactive, particularly in our own region because of the legal regimes I mentioned before, and particularly because of the impact of those laws in Papua New Guinea and the Solomons on the spread of HIV. But that hasn't happened yet. Now, I don't think it's necessarily an issue for the Prime Minister. I mean, he is quite a conservative man, but the only time I've ever actually talked to him was about this particular issue. And we talked about the plight of LGBT people in places like Saudi Arabia and Iraq, but also Malaysia and Papua New Guinea. And he was very open to Australia advocating more strongly on this. I think it really lies in our hands as a community to be pushing the government, because the government has so many other issues on the plate. I think we need to be in there saying, look, this is what's happening in countries around the world, particularly countries that we have a closer relationship to, and this is what you can do. And if we did that, I've got no doubt that they would.
Yeah. It's a question of making it a priority, isn't it? Not just agreeing in principle.
And the only way that's going to happen is if we raise our voices as a community.
Yeah.
And those MPs who support our community in the federal parliament do the same.
So is there anything happening at the moment? Or I guess for people listening who are going, well, I'd like to do that, but how do I do it? Is there a particular avenue that you would advise them to go through, or just their local MP?
If they have a local MP, and this is probably the case in Melbourne more than in other places, so yes, I'd strongly urge it. If they have a local MP who does have a knowledge of and support for LGBT human rights, then write to them raising this issue and say, in a positive light, there are abuses happening around the world, but the Australian Labor Party has a record on advocating against this in multilateral forum like the UN and in our bilateral relationships with places like Papua New Guinea or China or Philippines or wherever it might be. I urge you to continue to do that or to do it more. And I'd also urge people to write to the Foreign Minister because it really lies in the Foreign Minister's hands. And if that person gets just 10 letters on this issue, then you can be sure it'll go to the top of the agenda.
Really? Just 10 letters would be enough to do that?
Because they get nothing at the moment. I mean, they really... 10 or 20.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that shouldn't be...
to the top of the agenda, I mean, to the top of the agenda of Australia's human rights advocacy overseas. At the moment, it's not even on that agenda.
Yeah.
But if enough people were to write in, and it doesn't require hundreds, if it's, you know, just a couple of dozen...
Well, there you go. We've got a couple of dozen...
needs to happen.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, advisors go, oh, what have we done in the past? Oh, we did all this good stuff at the UN. Let's do that again. I'm afraid to say governments often work in that kind of ad hoc way.
Yeah, well, I imagine that's the case. I mean, we've got more than two dozen listeners at Joy, so we should get, 500-600 letters out of this interview, folks.
And there you go.
Get writing.
Yeah, obviously it's timely because of the resolution at the UN. To kind of jump on that now.
Exactly. And so I'd imagine a model letter would go something like, we welcome the fact that you're supporting the resolution before the General Assembly on the criminalisation of homosexuality, and we urge you to take that further by becoming a stronger advocate against the abuse of LGBTI human rights around the world, particularly our own region, in the same way that you were in the early 90s. Simple as that.
Rodney, thank you for joining us on Saturday Magazine this morning, and we go and get writing. But listen to the end of Saturday Magazine first, folks, and then at 12 o'clock, don't worry about whatever program's on after this, start writing your letters. That's a bad thing to say, isn't it? Rodney, thank you for joining us this morning.
I'm sure people can write and listen at the same time.
I'm sure
they can.
Thank you. You're listening to Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9 with Jeff Hood and Mark Gardner. And it's time for...
Community Roundup, and we'll whiz through this so we can get onto our fabulous journey.
It's La Receta from Kimo the Blaxican. You're listening to Joy 94.9, Saturday Magazine with Mark Gardner and Jeff Hood.
And our guest this morning, and I'm going to read what our fabulous producer Kimberly has written about our guest this morning. Graphic artist, curator, gay parent, Chilean-born, Spanish-speaking, home renovator, and all-round nice guy. Welcome, Francisco Fisher, to Joy 94.9.
Hi, Mark. Hi, Jeff. How are you?
Good.
And
yourself?
And I can guarantee that he is an all-round nice guy because we've been chatting for a little while, and he's gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous. Chilean born, when did you come to Australia?
1972, which is usually a few years before everybody else did.
We left
when Allende came into power. My mother was from a communist family, but my father was from a very right-wing family. So there were problems there when Allende came into power. And my parents were worried that basically Chile would turn into another Cuba, right, and we wouldn't be able to leave. So
yep,
we kind of left very quickly. Within a week, we'd
okay.
left.
Okay. And how old were you?
I turned 5 about a month after we got here.
So do you have much memory of that?
A couple of... Not really. I remember my parents worked, had a sheep farm. So I remember flying over the Andes on my dad's plane looking for sheep. I remember horse riding. And that's about it, really. Mm. Not much else.
And being ripped out of your home as a 5-year-old and your friends must have been quite amazing.
I think my eldest brother... It was worse for him.
Yes.
I just remember the flight over was stopping in Tahiti, Numia, Easter Island. So all I remember is very strong smelling flowers.
Have you been back since then? Or?
I have, but 20 years ago.
Right.
And that was odd because we still couldn't speak about Pinochet in people's houses at that, right. At that stage. I was asked to leave a couple of houses because I just didn't know how that worked.
Yeah.
Now
because of their feelings about him or suspicion, like what
suspicion?
Was
you just yeah. never knew it. You could be reported by a family member. You could be reported by by a maid. And you've got to understand, most of the middle class in Chile have some sort of home help. When you have a poor community that's working for the middle class, they'll quite happily sell anyone off for money the same way the middle class will do it to themselves.
Yes.
And what was it like coming to a strange country where the language was different, where everything, I would assume,
it actually
was
wasn't that different. Chileans tend to blend into Western communities quite well. You don't have hubs of Chilean people the way you would Italians or Greeks.
Yep.
We came over here speaking 2 languages. We could already speak English before we got here.
Right.
So it wasn't that difficult. I remember my parents talking about how appalling the food was in Australia in the 70s. All you could get was French food and chops that were just burnt to the shithouse, basically.
Because Chile was great meat producers, yeah?
Yeah, Argentina's better,
yeah.
Although you'd never hear a Chilean say that. But, but yeah, we produce a fair amount of meat.
Yeah.
Is there a strong Chilean culture in Melbourne or in Australia? Like you said, there isn't this kind of ghetto formation, but is there some identification and kind of gatherings that would happen? Or
there are gatherings. It's odd because we're not as visible.
Yeah.
Because we're smaller in numbers. I don't know about Melbourne because I've only been in Melbourne now for 10 months.
Right.
And I was never a part of a Chilean community in Sydney.
I think probably a bit more visible in Melbourne. Like I can sort of, I have an image of Chilean people and the Chilean flag and groups of Chilean people when there's been a tennis player at the Australian Open or, South American festivals and things like that. Yeah.
Yes. So I mean, I'm sure that there's the Chilean communities out there would say, no, we're very, very visible, but they've just never been a part of my life.
Yeah.
So growing up, Sydney... You moved to Sydney with your family?
Sydney. Lived in 12 different places in the first 5 years when we got to Australia.
Okay.
We moved between Sydney and Canberra, eventually settled in the Blue Mountains there. That was tough. First 5 years was really tough. My parents were... The migration process was just terrible.
Right.
Especially as it was so far away. It wasn't to America, it wasn't somewhere where you could get to easily.
Do you mean terrible emotionally for them or the bureaucratic process of migration?
The bureaucratic process was fine. We were in. We were political exiles.
Right.
We were just sucked in. We were put into a... In those days, they dumped you in old army bases.
Yep.
And there was no... That was about it for support. And we had to leave because Mum was noticing that there were men hanging around the tap where the kids used to go and get buckets of water.
Right.
And that just got a bit spooky and, okay. and we were out of there.
Yep.
But it just meant that suddenly we were on our own. There was I have three other brothers, so the six of us were on our own with, I think, an uncle who was over here at the
time. So was the fact that you had an uncle here the reason that your parents chose Australia?
No, it was Australia or Canada.
Right.
They made that decision really quickly. They don't talk about that stuff very much. It's kind of difficult for them. But so I'm not quite sure why Australia. I'm really pleased they did, though.
Canada's nothing, a nice place.
Canada's a fantastic place, But I'm very
touch
happy
cooler
here.
Than here. But
yes,
yeah.
So what path did you? Obviously, it was difficult. You moved obviously lots of schools. You had to make new friends all the time. 12 different places in 5 years is quite incredible. Once you did settle in the Blue Mountains, you must have been kind of heading towards secondary school almost. Or end of primary school, and so tell us kind of that journey that took you into being a grown up.
Settled really easily. It was fantastic. My parents mentioned once when we moved there that they were thinking about moving again, and it took my brother to just burst into tears and say, "We just can't keep doing this," for them to actually decide to put roots down.
Yep.
But we loved it. We thrived on being still for a while, and it was quite regional there, so we had lots of space to run around, which is what we were used to in Chile. And it wasn't until high school, really, that it started to get a bit trickier, and we were the WOG kids in a very, very Anglo kind of community.
Yes.
And so my brothers and I made decisions whether we would choose to be very, very Australian or whether we would choose to not be Australian. I was less Australian. One of my brothers was completely Australian. He gave up his language, his original language.
And took on the whole Ocker thing? Or
absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
So what influenced your choice to do it the other way?
I guess always knowing that I was interested in boys kind of separated me from everyone anyway.
Yeah.
So I was, and I knew that from a very young age, so I'd already started separating myself and was able to always stand back and look at what was going on around me.
If I don't fit in, well, a little bit more not fitting in won't matter so much.
Yeah, and I guess it was also making clever choices, really.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm wondering if it was easier to be a Chilean boy that was a bit different than an Ocker. I mean, you couldn't be the Ocker jockstrap kind of fella, I guess.
Yeah, no.
Easier to fit in another way.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. And being a nerd.
Being a nerd. Well, on that nerdy note, we might hear a little more music. We've got a few announcements to make first, but tell us about your next music choice. Valerie Amy Winehouse, the Mark Ronson remix, and that was the choice of our guest in Journeys this morning, Francisco Fisher.
Yes.
Cisco. We debated whether to call him Cisco Fisher, but decided that didn't sound quite too good. Cisco, you were saying earlier about knowing that you were gay very young, and we've had a bit of a discussion in the studio while the music came about when we thought we were gay. And how young were you, and how did you know?
I don't think I consciously knew I was gay. Mm. I had a talk with my partner about this, and we both kind of experienced the same thing of, you know, having fetishes on the Target catalogue men when we were quite young, but not actually understanding that very much.
Did you buy Target underwear? Not if you were gay. I shouldn't say that. Warning everyone who shops at Target, me included.
But I kind of always knew there was a difference there. And then my parents, and to all parents, gay and straight, don't send your children to a doctor to ask your children if they're gay. It freaks them out. So I kind of had the fear of God put into me by my doctor at about 11.
So why did your parents do that? Did they think you were different?
Yeah, I was a bit of a mama's boy, and when I was very young, I looked like a chick. People thought I was a girl straight away, and that kind of terrified my father.
Right.
Being a Latino.
What do they want the doctor to do exactly? Like send you for some sort of psychotherapy, or
no? They just
injection or what?
I think they were just scared out of their minds to ask me. There was no information for parents in the 70s.
So it's like, we'll dump it on the doctor.
Yeah,
well,
pretty much. I said no to him, and then they asked my eldest brother to ask me because they were that scared.
I guess in some ways you've got to give them some credit for actually noticing that that you were not the same as all of the rest of them, and for trying to do something about it, I guess, rather than just going
and to be honest,
ignore him and force him into a marriage, and that'll be all right.
They would have been fine with it. When I finally did come out, and that was after a marriage where they'd flown to England for the wedding, that kind of stuff. They held a big coming out party for me when I came out, so it was all good.
I guess you were talking about earlier that you had a communist and a right wing parent. Clearly, they were open to variety.
Yes. Yeah. Well, actually, if anything, I'd say the communists were probably more conservative than the right-wingers, but the right-wingers would never admit to it.
Right.
Communists tended to be very conservative.
So, in terms of issues like sexuality, do you mean, or across the board?
Across the board, really. And my mother came from a very old communist family that had gone to Paraguay to set up a utopia. And that's where my grandmother grew up and was born. So there was always that sort of tagged along. But then she met my father, who was very right-wing and really moneyed. So they were incredibly educated, had experienced a lot. So that kind of opened up her world for her.
What this is a very broad question because we're talking about two different time periods, but I'm wondering about the attitude towards homosexuality in Chile then and now. Like, is it the same as anywhere else, like Australia, or is it tighter or more liberal? Like, I'm trying to get a sense of where the culture that your parents came out of in terms of their attitudes to homosexuality.
About 10, 15 years ago, I think Chile was the second most homophobic country in the world.
Right.
And incredibly conservative. You know, you couldn't... Even when I went back there 20 years ago, men just didn't wear earrings, kids didn't put colour in their hair, you didn't wear ripped jeans. If you did, you were obviously an art student, you were middle class, and your parents were indulging you to a certain level, but you just didn't do it. Now, I... talking about Facebook now, I had to be outed when we started having because most of our families in South America, when their kids got old enough to go to university, some of them wanted to study here, so my parents had to out me in South America. They were really nervous about it. But with Facebook now, I've got photos of my kids on Facebook, that kind of stuff, and I have family contacting me all the time wanting to. But I have an uncle who, not an uncle, a cousin who's a doctor in South America, and he was imprisoned for a week, beaten, jailed, because there was a man who had molested and killed a child on a beach where he lived. And he was a doctor, and he was doing community work there. The money that he earned doing private practice was going into, he was putting it back into the community. So everyone knew he was gay, everyone was fine with it, but the police used him as a way of catching the other guy by going, we've caught him, the other guy came out,
so
then they found him.
It was a publicity thing. Yeah.
So he was outed and put on the front page of all the papers, he was beaten, jailed, and then released, and that was the last.
And what's happened since to him? Has that altered his life significantly?
He's still doing the work he does, and he has a friend that he goes to San Francisco once a year on his holidays, and is happy with his life.
So, Cisco, there's quite a journey then from being an 11-year-old sent to your local doctor to find out if you're gay and having your big brother try and get the information out of you, through being married and doing all of the career stuff in the process, and where you are now with a male partner and a son. That's a lot of water under the bridge.
Yeah, I'm just trying to process it. Thinking, I don't think I can say that and talk about that in a few minutes.
No, well, clearly you can't.
Well, can I ask you, like, you were married in 1994 and then divorced.
Yes.
What led you to get married? I mean, that might sound like an odd question. When we were talking before about you knowing maybe that you were gay earlier, do you have a sense of what was going on for you around that?
The sex stuff has never been an issue for me. I still, not anymore, but I've always had sex with women. I consider myself gay because my relationships are with men. My wife and I separated, my ex-wife and I separated more because we were having huge problems, not between us, but she came from a really wealthy family, and that was causing huge rifts And we were living in England, and I was miles away from my family and feeling very isolated.
Mm.
But
was she English? Or
yeah.
Yeah.
And it wasn't... And then when I came back to Australia, I had another long-term relationship with a woman and that kind of stuff. And then finally, I kind of thought, when that finished, and that woman was bisexual as well, and I said to her, when we'd finished, I said, I think I'm going to start trying relationships with men. And she said, great. Mm. And she went to the first bi support group with me, which is the most harrowing experience I've ever had, I think.
Well, it just goes to show, you know, the hormone replacement therapy that the doctor gave you when you were young didn't work, did it?
And then have never looked back, really. Mm. I love being gay. I love everything that I always had. Oh, it's really hard to put. The knowing that there's a difference in your life from a very early age suddenly makes sense.
Right.
And it all sort of gels together when you finally go, no, I'm actually gay. And I was very happy when I came out. I was sort of running around the streets, jumping for joy. I sort of outed myself in a really big way.
Sounds great.
Yeah. And so you have a partner, and you and your partner have a son?
Yes.
What's it like co-parenting and being a dad and all that?
Do you know, we all thought that co-parenting with four parents would be really easy. We thought, great, four parents, how easy is this? It's really tough on some level. Sharing the love over four people can be really, really tough. Mm. And then there are moments where you couldn't think of doing it any other way.
Well, what's the tough bit? Is it around negotiating, or is it just having, like, so many people focused on this child? What's the difficult bit?
When there's just two of you, you've already developed a relationship, and you kind of have established the way you would operate and that kind of stuff.
Mm.
We'd known Cara and Juliet for 10 years already, and we'd discussed for a year and a half before we actually started trying to get pregnant.
Mm.
But then the crunch comes, you have the baby and you realize that you're joined together forever.
Yes. Mm. Yeah.
And then you really have to start negotiating. You have to learn to be brave and say the stuff that you never said to them before, and vice versa. And you have to be brave enough to listen to what they have to say and go, I'm going to have to just bite the bullet.
You have to be a really big adult, don't you?
Yeah.
To co-parent with four people.
You have to grow up. So it's that's the tough stuff. Eddie's our son, makes it very easy. You just kind of look at him and he smiles, and it's worth it. It's absolutely worth it.
And he's currently nine months?
So 9 months?
Yeah,
he's crawling.
Still very young, yeah.
Big bugger.
So you're going through all those nice milestones of crawling and talking and walking and
getting covered in snot and food.
Yeah.
Is he looking very clean this morning, clearly, yeah.
Yes. I was with him this morning, and I've just rolled my sleeves up to cover up the snot stains.
It's all part of the fun, isn't it? We're speaking with Francisco Fisher, who is our Journeys guest this morning. Francisco's next music track, Jeffrey, who, by the way, we have a Bruce, our devoted Joy listener, who thinks our guest artist has a very sexy voice.
Good on you, Bruce.
Thanks, Bruce.
So, Cisco.
You should see him in person, Bruce.
With Cisco Fisher, with the sexy voice. Francisco Fisher, in fact.
Jeff's getting very carried
away.
Hope
you enjoyed that, Bruce. You've got a little bit more of Cisco's sexy voice to go. We haven't spoken at all about your career yet, and you've done quite a lot of different things, from making cocktails to being an artist to a whole range of things. Tell us what you've done career-wise, and we've got a few highlights that we'll mention if you don't as we go along.
Career-wise, hospitality, I think. I was an art student, work, became a chef through bar work.
It's like that T-shirt, you know, I'm an actor. Oh, can I take your order, please?
That's exactly what it is. And I was lucky enough to have my mother teach me how to cook, so I was able to fall into chefing really easily. Then from there, I threw my back, spent 6 months in bed, and started doing volunteer work in arts organisations where my degree was, and eventually became a curator. And then left that.
So you've curated the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras Gallery, the Australian Centre for Photography.
Yep. I also did the Phototechnica exhibition space. I set that up and then eventually got Cara Rees to run that, who's now the curator at the Centre for Contemporary Photography here in Melbourne.
Which is where you are
at the moment. Designer, yes, although I've just resigned and I'm just...
Breaking news.
And just I'm helping the new designer to sort of get settled in there.
And so where to?
Yeah, that's my next question.
Well, I'm currently doing 3 days a week at Family Planning Victoria, as they've just rebranded and doing all of their marketing collateral work. And I also do I have my own studio going, so I do a lot of work online now that you can.
Yeah, yeah. So graphic design in a very practical sense as well as the very creative and artistic sense.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
What's been the highlight of that career for you, or the highlights?
For the curating work, I would have to say working with Michael Riley,
yes,
who's an Indigenous Australian photographer who's sadly no longer with us, for his final body of work called Clouds. That work's gone on to travel the world. We'd originally curated it for the ACP. We'd printed it on canvas so I could travel to regional, really remote Indigenous communities. Mm. And it got picked up and it's travelled everywhere and it's won awards and it's a beautiful body of work. And it's a pity Michael's not with us now, because all of this happened.
He'd love it.
Yeah,
mm.
Yeah. So that for me was the highlight of my creative sort of arts-based career.
Yeah, yeah. Something to be very, very proud of. Mm. And it sounds like it wouldn't really have had the legs it's had if it wasn't for you.
No. It would have had the legs. The work was strong enough to have the legs all on its own. I just helped get it going.
You made it start.
Yes.
Fantastic. Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras Gallery, some of our listeners might be interested in.
Yes, that was when Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras had a gallery.
Right.
I ran it until we were closed down by Mardi Gras.
Yep.
And it was turned into the wardrobe department for costumes. It was a great gallery. We had work from all over the country. We had a National Acquisitive Award once a year. We actually had... And the strange thing was that the gallery had more lesbians going through it than were signed up as members of Mardi Gras.
Right.
So more lesbians came to Mardi Gras through us than through the gallery.
Wow.
Yeah.
Which was something that we told them before they closed us down, saying you're losing a huge link to a massive part of your community.
Yep.
Mm. What's the art scene like? You've moved to Melbourne quite recently, really. What's the scene like here? What is it a good place to be an artist, and I guess in particular a graphic artist?
Graphic arts are different. I think I, without biting myself in the ass, I think culturally Melbourne is probably the city to be in for the arts. You have rubbish beaches, but you have really good art.
Can't have everything.
No.
We've got the best gay men and the best lesbians.
True.
I mean, what else do you
very
want?
True. And I think for design, Melbourne is an extraordinary place to be.
Mm.
The competition's really fierce here for design in Melbourne. But there's less work in Melbourne than there is in Sydney.
Okay. So you're with Family Planning Victoria doing some very practical design work by the sound of it, I guess. Where would you hope to continue your journey?
I'll be starting web design soon. But really, I've just resigned from CCP to have more time with little Eddie, but also to start my creative practice again.
Yep.
So for me, it's going to be about doing my practical design and my web stuff, but also getting some exhibitions together. I'm being wound up here. I can hear it in the breath.
Yes. But Francisco is going to come back and tell us all about his first Melbourne exhibition when it's up and running.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Francisco, thank you for being our guest on Journeys this morning. Unfortunately, our time is running out very fast. We've been speaking with Francisco Fisher.
Thank you, Mary Jeff.
Melbourne. We didn't mention, by the way, that you're a prize-winning cocktail maker, but we'll talk about that at some other stage. We're just going to go out now after the program and have some cocktails made for us in the green room of Joy 94.9. Time to say farewell, Mark.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.